On 21 October, Aachen became the first city on German soil to be captured by the Allies, but not before the defending Germans had subjected the Americans to a bitter lesson in urban warfare. The U.S. assault got off to a bad start when 8 German assault guns and howitzers were able to break into the city, together with further German units, because the U.S. cordon was too thin. Then, when the Americans themselves broke into Aachen, the Germans took full advantage of the cityscape. Guidelines for urban warfare that the OKH issued at the end of August stressed that guile, deception, and the demeanor of a Red Indian bring more success than fighting according to strict rules and regulations. One of the Germans' favorite tricks was to use Aachen sewers to infiltrate and pop up in the Americans' rear. Tellingly, the Germans clearly had no qualms about using the kind of cunning for which they had condemned the Red Army at Stalingrad. On the other hand, a German after-action report produced following the fall of Aachen reflected how far the quality of German troops was diminishing. Infantry are making insufficient use of their numerous high-quality weapons and rely in the first instance on the artillery. Battalion commanders, chiefs, and platoon commanders show insufficient concern for the cooperation of all armed branches. They must learn to lead the fire. Without formidable defensive protection, such as the Westwall, then, there was a limit to what German troops could do. Where the Germans made the Americans suffer most, however, was in the Hürtgen Forest. Here, the Americans experienced a particularly painful dissonance between their thrusting tactical approach and the dispersing effect that the broad front approach had upon their strategic and operational level strength. Amid dense forest terrain and often appalling weather, they battered themselves against the Hürtgen in an operation that lasted from mid-November to mid-December. General Courtney Hodges committed 6 divisions to the Hürtgen campaign, each of which suffered an average of 5,000 casualties during the battle. Here the Americans found even Volksgrenadier units a fearsome proposition, if they were sufficiently well led. On 3 and 4 December, for instance, men of the 272nd Volksgrenadier Division, armed with Panzerfausts, blasted U.S. armor out of the village of Bergstein. The U.S. armor lacked sufficient infantry protection. The Volksgrenadiers were able to surprise it, thanks to the poor battlefield visibility imposed by the late arrival of daylight, and thanks also to the muffling effect of the cold air and snow as they approached the village from the woods. The Americans were eventually able to retake Bergstein, but not before the Volksgrenadiers and their own limited armored support had destroyed 8 out of 11 Shermans. One German NCO who took part in the attack recalled the furious melee. Tank against tank, hand-to-hand combat, tanks burning, loud noises of duels between men armed with Panzerfausts and tanks, burning and exploding tanks, men falling everywhere. And yet, in the Hürtgen, as in Aachen, the end result was never in doubt. The cost to the 272nd Volksgrenadier Division of its raid on Bergstein was appalling. Of the 528 men it committed to the attack, only 150 returned. The Volksgrenadiers also suffered the shattering effect of U.S. artillery. Thus did one soldier of the 272nd describe an artillery bombardment in December. The company had no time to take up this position to dig fighting positions on an open slope. We had no cover at all. Today one cannot imagine how afraid I was when I realized how exposed we were. During this fighting I realized just how much of a firepower advantage our opponents possessed. Everyone from the heavy machine gun section who could run, including myself, fled from our positions into a ravine to escape the killing artillery fire. Such incidents highlighted the basic underlying truth that, regardless of how justified or unjustified were the Germans' ongoing claims of man-for-man superiority, they ultimately could not ignore the decisive importance of materiel superiority, or the fact that the Western Allies commanded such superiority on a vast scale. As a U.S. 7th Army report of 12th October dryly observed, "It is typical of the Teutonic mind to belittle materiel superiority when he himself hasn't got it." Unlike the German troops on the Reich's western frontier, German troops in Italy did not face reinforced Allied armies. Resources and troops that might have remained with or gone to Allied forces in Italy had instead been sent to France for Operation Dragoon, and by the time the Germans faced the Allied armies along the new defensive position of the Gothic Line, they counted 26 divisions to the Allies' 21. General Vittinghoff called on commanders to ensure personally that the spirit for the fight is raised again, the troops restored to the full wish to resist. The Gothic Line, though longer than the Gustav Line, could be reinforced all along its length via a lateral road. Meanwhile, the Italian environment continued to come to the Germans' aid. At the end of August, the British launched Operation Olive against the Adriatic side of the Gothic Line, but poor weather and the typically arduous Italian terrain slowed them. At the western end of the Gothic Line, the Americans were unable to break through via the narrow coastal plain, and on the few occasions when the terrain did assist the Allies, they could overplay their hand, perhaps precisely because they were not used to having such an advantage. When they initially reached the Gothic Line, the British rashly concluded that the landscape of the Lombardy Plain made ideal tank country, and sent in armour cavalry charge style against a supposedly vulnerable point. In the dangerously open country, the Germans inflicted grievous losses upon them. Lieutenant Peter G. of the 114th Light Division described a similar encounter with Allied tanks in the Tiber Valley. "Every day, every night, the Lanza sits with open eyes in his hole, awaiting the enemy's armoured colossus. The day before yesterday was one of our most difficult, but also one of our most successful days. These beasts rolled up to our strong points. It was such a joy to knock out six of these heavy Sherman tanks in close combat. Then the ferocity of the autumn rains ground the Allied offensive to a halt." If anything, however, German troops in Italy viewed their longer-term prospects even more despondently than their comrades further north. Their air support was virtually non-existent, and their supply situation atrocious. The 114th Light Division testified to the troops' miserable condition. In December, its operations section noted that the fighting worth of the infantry had sunk to a worryingly low level. There was no prospect of better replacements, so the division would have to take steps itself. For instance, the operations section directed that soldiers should not be distributed individually along the main battle line, but in strong points of three or four men, with an appointed leader. He need not be an officer or NCO, but a cold-blooded, wolfish hunter type who could hold the strong point in critical situations. He was to punish cowardice, weakness, or insufficient attention to duty straight away, and cannot be hard enough. And here, too, the diminishing quality of both officers and men showed in their battlefield performance. On 10 January 1945, 68 Corps, to which the 114th belonged, informed it, "There must be no more cases of the infantry attacking before the artillery is ready, or the artillery shooting off all its ammunition and the infantry attacking after several hours' delay." 3 weeks later, it lashed the 114th with the criticism that none of the division's defensive outposts contained anti-tank ditches, stakes, or other obstacles. Stung into action, the division set the Italian population to work. Indeed, compelling civilians to convert their areas into defensive zones was a new source of misery for the populations of those remaining occupied territories adjacent to the Reich's borders. In the Tuscan and Emilian Apennines during the autumn of 1944, for instance, frontline German army troops press-ganged 12,000 Italian men for the purpose. Nowhere, however, did the German occupiers commit depredations more savage than against the Warsaw Uprising of August to October 1944. The main military organization within the Polish resistance, which was also the military wing of the Polish government in exile in London, was the Home Army, Armia Krajowa, or AK. The AK had not wanted to unleash a mass anti-German uprising too soon. To do so would have invited not only failure, but also devastating German reprisals. It had thus focused its previous efforts on building up its forces, and on activities such as intelligence gathering while waiting for an opportune moment to rise. August 1944 was not an opportune moment either, but now the AK felt it had no choice. With the Red Army's arrival imminent, the Soviets seemed destined to dominate Poland unless the AK could achieve something so dramatic that it would be taken seriously as a player in the country's future. The AK concluded that the best solution was to launch a mass uprising to liberate Warsaw from German occupation before the Red Army arrived. Throughout August and September, following their defeat by Field Marshal Model, Soviet forces in Poland paused and consolidated on the Vistula. Controversy continues to surround this action. They may have halted for operational reasons. They were still smarting from Model's blow and may also have feared outrunning their supplies. But they may also have halted because Stalin wished to allow the Germans a free hand to destroy the AK and thus eliminate it as a potential obstacle to a Soviet-dominated Poland. The Western Allies were reluctant to pressure Stalin to help the AK. They were also too far away to provide the AK with more than token assistance themselves. The AK, now effectively operating on its own, hoped to exploit its knowledge of Warsaw's layout during the rising. However, the AK itself would be exposed the moment it left the city's built-up areas and entered its open spaces. It would also need to capture heavily defended points such as airfields and radio stations. Worse, the AK was short of weapons. It also tragically underestimated the Germans' urban warfare skills, overlooking the painful but fruitful learning curve the Germans had undergone since their first ham-fisted attempt to take Warsaw in 1939. Among other things, the Germans' counteroffensive against the Warsaw Uprising would see them utilize not just their extensive urban warfare skills, but also a new weapon, the remote-controlled Goliath mobile explosive carrier, to demolish the AK's street barricades. The AK scored some initial successes against the Germans, but then the SS Chief of Anti-Bandit Operations, Obergruppenführer von dem Bach-Zelewski, took charge of the devastating response. There were atrocities on both sides, but the atrocities that some SS and police units committed were singularly depraved even by SS standards. Equally bloodthirsty were the anti-communist Eastern Auxiliaries whom Bach-Zelewski deployed. Army units such as the 19th Panzer Division also participated in the fighting. According to Polish eyewitnesses, some German units, army units in all likelihood, behaved considerately towards civilians caught in the fighting, though others did not. Unambiguously damning, however, was the role of General Guderian, who as OKH Chief of Staff raised no objection to the barbaric orders Hitler and Himmler issued during the battle, or to the so often barbaric prosecution of the battle itself. Also damning was the role of the Ninth Army, in whose operational area Warsaw was situated. Concerned above all to see the insurrection stamped out before it spread, the Ninth Army's single protest against the atrocities came on 8 August, when it raised the concern that prisoners should be deported in an orderly fashion. But much as German commanders had already used the Allied bombing of German cities to relativize their own scorched-earth operations and brutal anti-partisan measures, the Ninth Army also sought to relativize the savagery the Germans had unleashed in Warsaw by pointing out that women from the Reich have also been raped and shot. After the rising had been crushed, Hitler ordered the city destroyed, citing the need to eradicate it as a potential source of future resistance. The SS and police refrained from slaughtering the entire civilian population, as Hitler and Himmler had decreed in their infamous order for Warsaw of 1 August. They also treated AK survivors as POWs, if only to end hostilities sooner, and, with an eye to the increasingly likely scenario of Germany's defeat, to curry favor with the Western Allies. After the battle, Army Group A followed up this amnesty with a desperate effort to recruit Poles as volunteers for construction work. It called upon them to protect Europe to the last against Bolshevism, pledging that every honorable helper in this unconditional struggle will be welcomed by the Wehrmacht as a comrade. Many Poles, particularly from the now devastated Warsaw itself, were receptive, if only so as to escape destitution or worse. Indeed, while AK prisoners were sent to POW camps as part of the surrender agreement, 90,000 Warsaw citizens were eventually condemned to forced labor and another 60,000 to concentration camps. And in late October, army units were involved in the brutal crushing of another uprising, this time in the mountains of Slovakia, again under the auspices of the SS. Unsurprisingly, given what happened to the risings in Warsaw and Slovakia, the remaining occupied populations of Western Europe were disinclined to try anything similar. This did not spare them the final ravages of German occupation, however. Norway was a prime example. In August 1943, the Germans had imposed direct administration on Norway to replace the hapless collaborationist Quisling government. Hitler was loath to abandon Norway, not just because it was home to the naval bases from which he hoped to unleash the next generation of U-boats, but also because it still provided extensive economic materials and labor. That said, German efforts to maintain the labor draft in Norway received a serious blow in August. The Germans tried to withhold ration cards from those who did not register for the labor draft, but the resistance put paid to that idea by hijacking a lorry load containing 150,000 such cards. But during the occupation's final months, Norway suffered an Eastern Front-style scorched earth policy. In the summer of 1944, 370,000 German troops were stationed in Norway, but then the figure rose to over 500,000. After Germany's Finnish allies changed sides in September, the 20th Mountain Army, hitherto Germany's northernmost field army in the Soviet Union, pulled back into Norway with its full strength. Norway itself was now directly exposed to Soviet attack. The Norwegian province of Finnmark bordered the Soviet Union, and in October 1944, Hitler ordered the 20th Mountain Army to evacuate and devastate it. He sought to deprive any Red Army advance of supplies, and also to prevent it from cultivating the province's population and thus achieving a propaganda victory. Ironically, of course, the mass evacuation and destruction that the 20th Mountain Army now visited upon Finnmark's population was hardly good pro-German propaganda either. Between 40 and 50,000 people were evacuated and their homes destroyed in a manner so thorough that only a well-functioning army could be capable of it, in the words of the 20th's own war diary. 120,000, mainly Soviet and Serbian POWs, employed as forced laborers, were also evacuated southwards. An OKW directive of 28 October justified Finnmark's laying to waste by wheeling out the now routine line that the German measures were humane compared with the Allied bombing of German cities. It also claimed that the evacuated population would thank the Germans for delivering them from Bolshevism. Both rationales shine further light on the Germans' efforts to deflect blame for the devastation inflicted by their scorched earth policies during the war's final 2 years. Apart from a handful of isolated fortress ports, the only French territories still in German hands were the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine. The army and the security police destroyed villages and removed crops, cattle, and horse-drawn transport from a 5-kilometer, 3-mile zone behind the front line there. Members of the population aged between 15 and 60, capable of carrying arms, were to be taken eastwards over the Rhine. Eventually, the Germans transported about 7,000 civilians from the two provinces to the Reich. But army commanders in Alsace and Lorraine did show some restraint. On 30 September, L Army Corps and Wehrkreis 5 protested against this deportation order. Not only did they lack the facilities to evacuate the men, they also feared that the men would take the first opportunity to abscond and join resistance groups. The 19th Army was at least able to get the upper age limit of the deportees lowered to 45. It also refrained from having partisans either shot or sent to concentration camps in Germany, and ordered between 400 and 500 children evacuated from an area threatened by Allied artillery fire. The commanders who made these decisions may have been concerned for their morality or for their own future in the increasingly likely event of Germany's defeat, but the civilians who felt the effects would have been too relieved to be concerned about what the Germans' actual motives were. The Netherlands, a hitherto relatively favored corner of the Nazi Empire, suffered hardships far worse than anywhere else in occupied Western Europe during the final months of 1944. The two successive catalysts were the Allied liberation of the south of the country, which raised hopes among the northern Dutch that their own deliverance was at hand, and the failure of Operation Market Garden, which dashed their hopes and increased their frustration. Sabotage and assaults on German personnel now increased. In October 1944, a Wehrmacht car was attacked near the town of Putten, and General Christiansen, the Wehrmacht commander in the Netherlands, responded ferociously. He ordered the arrest of most of the town's male inhabitants aged between 17 and 50. 600 were sent to the Neuen Gamma concentration camp, where most died. The women and children were evacuated, and the town was burnt to the ground. Ignoring saner counsel from his local commanders, Christensen believed such harshness would deter future resistance. It only increased it. Hitherto, Christensen's conduct of security had not been excessively heavy-handed towards the general Dutch population. His action against Putten during this dying phase of occupation, then, seems to have been a frustrated act of lashing out. The contrast with those commanders in Alsace and Lorraine who sought to exercise restraint during the occupation's final months is striking. Yet even the ordeal of Putten was dwarfed by what the hunger winter of 1944-1945 inflicted upon the occupied Dutch population. In September, Dutch railway workers, thinking liberation was imminent, staged a strike to try and disrupt the Germans' response to Operation Market Garden. When the liberation did not happen, Hitler retaliated for reasons both economic and vengeful. Wehrmacht forces were ordered to seize thousands of Dutch workers and requisition a panoply of economically useful items, from bicycles, ships and trams to cows, coal and textiles. The Reich Commissar, Arthur Seyss Inquart, declared a state of emergency, making every disturbance of public order a capital offence and granting both Christensen and senior SS and police leader Hans Albin Rauter the authority to execute resistors summarily. Field Marshal Montgomery, his eyes fixed on Germany, was not prepared to distract himself with a renewed push into the Netherlands to alleviate Dutch suffering. That winter, the chaos that the German measures caused to food supplies precipitated mass starvation among the occupied Dutch. But by December 1944, such ransacking of the remnants of occupied Europe no longer brought significant benefit to the German war economy. Indeed, while the Allied armies were temporarily checked at the German frontiers, Allied strategic bombing was raining mortal blows on German industry. Even before Germany lost the Romanian oil fields in September, Allied air power was already devastating Germany's oil supply. After that, each successive month brought fresh calamity. October saw a massive direct attack on the Krupp works at Essen in the Ruhr, and November an especially intensive Allied bombing campaign against German transport and communications that hammered railways and canals the hardest. Indeed, outside the Ruhr, it was the destruction of the German transport system that caused the eventual collapse of German industry. To take just one example, shipments of Ruhr coal to factories fell from 20,000 to 7,700 wagons per day between September and October. The lack of coal forced numerous power plants to close and desolated German iron and steel production. Events during December exposed not just the terminal decline of the German war economy, but also the transient nature of the recovery the German army had made since September. With the new generation Type 21 U-boats still far from ready for mass service, Hitler sought a more immediate way of halting or even reversing the decline in Germany's fortunes. By December, the Wehrmacht had used the absence of any major Allied offensives against the Reich's borders to recuperate and re-equip its divisions. The Wehrmacht had also benefited from the long gestation period in armaments production. This meant that although armaments production was already terminal, output of almost all weapon types reached an absolute peak that month. Hitler was now resolved to launch the Wehrmacht in a counteroffensive against the Western Allies. Hitler hoped that the operation, codenamed Wacht am Rhein, Watch on the Rhine, would shake the Western Allies with an attack so sudden and shocking that it would render them powerless, enable the Germans to face the Red Army on more equal terms, and contribute to splitting the unnatural Allied coalition by making the Western Allies realize that Germany could not be defeated. Wacht am Rhein was influenced by the success of 1940's Sickle-Cut Plan. As in 1940, the Germans would advance through the thickly forested, weakly held Ardennes sector, drive for the sea and cut the Allied armies in two. This time, the ultimate target of the German drive was to be Antwerp, a port essential to Allied supply. The forces assembled for the Ardennes offensive comprised two panzer armies and one infantry army. The 6th Panzer Army, commanded by Oberstgruppenführer Josef Sepp Dietrich and concentrating all the Waffen-SS divisions committed to the offensive, was to spearhead the attack at its northernmost point between Monschau and Losheim. Its left flank was to be shadowed by General of Panzer Troops Hasso von Manteuffel's 5th Panzer Army, which was to cross the River Meuse at Dinant. To the left of this, General Erich Brandenberger's 7th Army was to advance towards Arnon. The Ardennes sector was lightly held by American troops, for the Allies were making the same mistake their predecessors had made in 1940. Although they had detected German troop movements, they believed any attack would come in east of Aachen. They also believed the Germans' fuel and manpower were too low to enable them to carry out a large operation, and that the habitually cautious Field Marshal von Rundstedt would anyway not contemplate such an operation. They were correct in this. What they were overlooking was that Hitler, not Rundstedt, was making the decisions. Here the Allies were ignoring an intelligence review that 21st Army Group had carried out. The report ascribed no importance to Rundstedt's position, and concluded, "The task of commander-in-chief in any German theatre has degenerated into that of local chief of staff to Hitler, and liable to dismissal as much for carrying out quaint orders as for protesting against them." German hopes for the attack, scheduled for mid-December, were further raised by predictions that poor winter weather over northwest Europe would ground Allied aircraft for its duration. It is difficult to assess how German soldiers felt about the upcoming offensive. Certainly the new Volksgrenadier divisions suffered from poor morale, but the now talismanic figure of Field Marshal Model, whose Army Group B would carry out the offensive, wove a certain magic among the older veterans. However, Model himself, as well as Rundstedt, was deeply skeptical about the plan. They preferred a small solution, such as encircling U.S. troops around Liège. It is doubtful whether even this would have succeeded, but Model and Rundstedt certainly had excellent reasons for skepticism about Wacht am Rhein. To cite three, the quality of manpower across the three armies, though high in some places, was chronically deficient in others. The Germans only had fuel for the first 60 kilometers, 38 miles, and would have to forage for it to make up the final 50 kilometers, 31 miles, to Antwerp. For secrecy's sake, many German units were brought up to the forward areas too close to the time of the attack, and did not have time to reconnoitre the ground. To cite a fourth, Germany's panzer force, upon which the offensive's success depended more than anything else, was not quite a shadow of its old self, but the offensive expected too much from it, and not only in view of the fuel shortage. The autumn of 1944 saw the birth of the final generation of German armoured fighting vehicles, the Tiger II and the JP-470 and Jagdpanzer tank destroyers. The new tank destroyers were excellent vehicles, but the Tiger II, though generally a fine tank, added little beyond what the Tigers and Panthers already offered, other than an imposingly massive presence on the battlefield, and that at the expense of correspondingly massive resources. Most fundamentally, the Normandy campaign had already shown that many panzer crews no longer met the old standard, and the hastily trained replacement crews that would see action in the Ardennes were, if anything, even worse. Given that the new panzer crews now only received a few weeks' training compared with 21 weeks at the war's start, they could hardly be blamed for this. Such veteran crews as did remain, particularly in the 5th Panzer Army, were battle-weary by now. Yet when Wacht am Rhein fell upon the weakly held Ardennes sector in the early hours of 16 December, it initially achieved impressive successes. The news seems to have raised morale, at least tentatively, at the front and at home. Unteroffizier Werner P. of the 12th Panzer Division, stationed in Courland, wrote on 19 December, "Losses and hard fighting stand before us, not least up here in Courland, but we know that things are moving forward in the west again, and one day the hour of reckoning will follow in the east as well." On the same day, Lieutenant Hans B. of the 337th Infantry Division described the news as "just wonderful. There's an enthusiasm here which we haven't known for a long time." Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division under Army Group Center was particularly relieved that the attack removed the immediate danger to his home in the Saarland. It soon became obvious just how misplaced such hopes were. The 6th Panzer Army's advance was particularly meagre. Badly mauled in the Normandy campaign and almost entirely bereft of their old recruiting grounds across occupied Europe, the Waffen-SS divisions that fought in the Ardennes revealed themselves as less replenished and less effective than Hitler had expected. Manteuffel's 5th Panzer Army fared better, forcing a large part of an American division to surrender near Saint-Vite on 18 December. After the initial shock, however, U.S. units across the Ardennes sector began displaying the resourcefulness and resilience with which German commanders had consistently failed to credit them, and they endured against the odds without waiting for higher-level orders. In particular, the 5th Panzer Army only captured Saint-Vite itself on 21 December, and could not crack U.S. resistance at the vital crossroads town of Bastogne. American resistance exposed not only the frailty of Wacht am Rhein's strength, but also the folly, of which the Germans were still guilty, of judging the American soldier as inferior. Lieutenant Willy Engel, a Panzer platoon commander, described his battalion commander's face as a picture of dejection and resignation after the Americans repulsed their attack. The failed attack and painful losses obviously depressed him severely. The knocked-out panzers offered a distressing picture. At that moment, a single panzer approached the command post. Suddenly, only about 100 meters, 330 feet away, it turned into a flaming torch. It was later determined that an immobile but otherwise serviceable Sherman had scored the hit. Such scenes encapsulated the tenacity American units showed in defiance of the arrogant, ideologically colored German expectations of them. But it was the state of the 7th Army, with its important flanking role, that said most about the German Army's failings by this stage in the war. It consisted mainly of new Volksgrenadier divisions, the best that could be said of which was that their men were enthusiastic and hopeful of victory. Like the other formations earmarked for the Ardennes offensive, they had been assigned high priority in the supply of weapons, but they consisted of either excessively youthful troops or troops hitherto considered unfit for combat duty. Their training was defective. So calamitous had been the German Army's losses in summer 1944 that there was no longer time to put new recruits through a more rigorous program. The junior officers were as deficient as the men. What they showed in enthusiasm, they lacked in rigorous training for all practical aspects of their role. The 272nd Infantry Division's performance in the Hürtgen Forest had shown what Volksgrenadier troops were capable of if well led and deployed in defense. Conversely, the 7th Army's performance in the Ardennes showed what Volksgrenadier troops were incapable of if poorly led, which was the norm, and ordered to attack. Unsurprisingly, the 7th Army achieved only minor breakthroughs. With German progress faltering and the Allied front strengthening, it took little time before the weather cleared and Allied formations brought in from other sectors counterattacked in force. From Christmas Day onwards, the battle entered its most decisive phase, because the weather improved. The Allies hit the already stalled German forces with powerful airstrikes. General von Mellenthin described the state of the 9th Panzer Division, which he visited on 29 December amid the wooded hills northwest of Ufalies. The ice-bound roads glittered in the sunshine, and I witnessed the uninterrupted air attacks on our traffic routes and supply dumps. Not a single German plane in the air. Innumerable vehicles were shot up, and their blackened wrecks littered the roads. Grenadier Egon T. of the 15th Panzer Grenadier Division, fighting with the 5th Panzer Army, recounted his experience of the battle's latter phase. "We buggered off out of Erfurt on 16 December, then drove 70 kilometers, 44 miles, east of Bonn and the Rhine. From there we marched to the front, 330 kilometers, 206 miles. Can you imagine that? But I had no blisters on my feet. On the same day we slept and then marched through the whole night from 5 in the evening until 7 in the morning, and that with machine guns to carry. We went into action on 1 January. From there I saw the Americans for the first time, 50 meters, 165 feet away, and me behind a machine gun. I felt queasy at first, but I would have sold my life as dearly as possible. I really stuck at it, but the bastards have so many aircraft and artillery, and they hammer away relentlessly, too." In an effort to draw Allied troops away from the Ardennes and further raise civilian morale, Hitler launched two diversionary offensives in Alsace. These operations failed essentially for the same reasons as Wacht am Rhein, together with their lack of any comparable armoured punch. The smaller of the two offensives involved the 198th Infantry Division. Many of its rank-and-file troops had not even completed their training, and the two March battalions were worst of all. They consisted of people who, by virtue of their age and physical failings, were far below average for a grenadier regiment. Heaping on the misery as New Year came was the state of the German Army's air cover, for on 1 January the Luftwaffe launched a mass attack on Allied airfields in the west, but in the process lost more aircraft and crews itself, losses that it could not replace. Luftwaffe anti-aircraft units, kept in the dark about the attack for secrecy's sake, accidentally shot down some of the planes themselves. By the end of January, the Western Allies had driven the Germans back all along their front. In the Ardennes, the Allies squandered an opportunity to decapitate the German force in the bulge its advance had created. Montgomery counterattacked in the north in coordination with U.S. forces south of the bulge, but only moved 2 days after he was supposed to. By the middle of January, the Germans had conducted a fighting retreat back to their start line. Nevertheless, they had lost nearly 11,000 men killed and nearly 35,000 men wounded, including most of what remained of their best troops, together with between 600 and 700 irreplaceable vehicles. In Alsace, the strength of the Allied counterthrusts, combined with the dire condition of their own supply, munitions, and transport, threw the Germans into disarray. "We are just waiting for one thing," wrote Corporal Hans W. of the 11th Panzer Division, "and that is the end of this battle for existence." This was not a fighting retreat, but a pell-mell bolt to the east, along muddy roads littered with mechanized transport and self-propelled weaponry abandoned for want of fuel. The wreckage said everything about the state of the German army, and indeed about the prospects of the Reich itself. That the German army held the line on the German frontiers during the last few months of 1944 was due less to its own remaining defensive strengths, or to the Allies' operational failings, numerous though both still were, than to the internal supply lines from which it benefited. Nevertheless, the German army's replacement system and the German armaments industry, beleaguered though they were, had yet to collapse entirely, and the army could still defend tenaciously and launch local counterattacks that deterred the Allies from pressing forward more swiftly. But the outcome of the war was no longer in reasonable doubt. As to why the German army continued to hold out, fear of defeat and its consequences continued to animate soldiers at all levels. So did soldiers' increasingly desperate hope that the Reich's miracle weapons might yet turn the tide, or that the Allied coalition might fragment. Faith in Hitler also remained alive, if less fervently than before, among the soldiery. More fundamentally, the army held on because, with the purge of the officer corps and the further encroachment of the SS upon its turf, it was more subordinate than ever to the Nazi regime. Its senior officers abased themselves, and its soldiers were fearful of the ever more ferocious discipline the army now imposed upon them. Strength through fear, General Schirdner's dictum, held sway ever more firmly. Fear of the Red Army, albeit less so of the Western Allies, was a further reason to continue the struggle. Soldiers also fought on, as before, for the basic reasons of survival and comradeship. In what remained of the foreign territory the Germans occupied, armed uprisings and the Reich's increasingly desperate economic and strategic situation precipitated a final bout of terror and exploitation. Despite this, the example of Alsace and Lorraine showed that, for whatever moral or pragmatic reasons, army units' conduct could also display some humanity during this final phase of occupation. The Ardennes offensive of December 1944 was the final time the German army attacked with a rational, if unrealistic, military objective. Its failure, and that of Hitler's diversionary offensives in Alsace, confirmed the brittle, temporary nature of the recovery that the army had undergone since its near collapse of August and early September. By now, the state of its replacement system was critical, the state of German armaments production terminal. The failure of the Ardennes offensive only hastened the German army's complete destruction. As one infantry captain who had participated in the Ardennes offensive put it, We finished the battle where we had started it. Then I knew, that's it. Chapter 24. The Army Self-Destructs, 1945. After the failure of the Ardennes offensive, the war emphatically reached German soil. During the conflict's final months, the German army's brilliant, futile fighting defense of the Heimat, as Max Hastings aptly describes it, ultimately helped achieve nothing more than the total destruction of itself and its homeland. It was able to fight on as long as it did, partly because of the final twitchings of its military effectiveness. Its motives, however, now had less to do with fervent Nazi beliefs or with any lingering hope of a strategic turnaround than with desperation and fear. Although the Ardennes offensive had been misconceived, the hopes that had been invested in it at least had some kind of strategic rationale. If there was any rationale to fighting on after the offensive failed, it lay in the increasingly slender hope of miracles, be they the Type 21 U-boats or other alleged Wunderwaffen, or something unanticipated. Though there was no real substance to these hopes, it probably seemed preferable to dwell upon them than upon the horror conjured by the looming prospect of defeat. But if most generals were sensible enough to realize all this, so all-pervading was the suppression of dissent within the officer corps that they did not voice their opinions openly. Instead, they continued to collude in the self-destruction of their army and, by extension, of their country. During the war's final months, all General Guderian's actions as OKH Chief of Staff were driven, or so he would later claim, by a search for rational solutions to the increasingly dire situation. What apparently passed for a rational solution in Guderian's mind, given the increasingly pitiful means at his disposal, was the fortress cities. These, he declared, would be as rocks against the Allied tide, consuming the latter's manpower and resources, and buying time for the Germans to regroup for the decisive counterattack. Deranged as this sounds, it is probable that Guderian did not believe a word of it. He is more likely to have seen extolling fortress cities as a means of keeping in with the regime, whether for the sake of his career or his safety. Calculation also seems to have dictated Guderian's choice of which cities to designate as fortresses. They were all in the east, and although Guderian, as OKH Chief of Staff, was responsible for the east rather than the west, it seems he was privately open to the idea of a separate peace with the Western Allies. The strength of the fortress cities' defenses varied greatly. Most were poorly provisioned and garrisoned by older troops with little, if any, recent combat experience. As Andreas Kuntz wryly observes, relying upon military measures from the Middle Ages was a dramatic come-down for the self-styled creator of Germany's panzer force. If Guderian did feel the need to show there was something to cling to, it was increasingly difficult to find it in the field army. Losses over the winter, with over 600,000 Wehrmacht fatalities in December and January, devastated the army's replacement system further. The army increasingly comprised a mess of inter-service personnel. We had Luftwaffe personnel, recalled General von Mellenthin, police, old men and boys, special battalions composed of men with stomach troubles or men with ailments. Even well-equipped units from Germany had received virtually no training and came straight from the parade ground to the battlefield. Indeed, in the army's desperation, it began to devour its replacement system, as well as its supply and logistical services. When training instructors and supply and logistical troops were drafted into combat units themselves, the collapse of the entire rear echelon system itself began setting in. Our precious reserves had been expended, recalled Mellenthin, and nothing was available to ward off the impending catastrophe in the east. During the first few months of 1945, the Allies abandoned their caution of the previous autumn. Knowing that Germany was terminally weakened following the destruction of its industry and the winter exertions of the Wehrmacht in the west, they breached the Reich itself on both fronts. First off the mark was the Red Army. On 12 January, while the bulk of the Wehrmacht's armoured force was still committed in the west, the 1st Ukrainian Army Group and 1st Belarusian Army Group attacked on the Vistula either side of Warsaw. The Soviet forces were now able to pursue deep battle to its logical extreme, concentrating their forces to penetrate the German defences with minimum loss of time and life. In the Magnusev bridgehead, for instance, they outnumbered the Germans 10-1. To service Hitler's offensives in the west, the Eastern Front was dangerously undermanned. The Luftwaffe in the east, for example, had 300 fighters to face around 10,500 Soviet aircraft. Guderian, Galen, and various field commanders in the east had long anticipated the attack and also worked out the date, yet they could not convince Hitler of the danger. Hitler's determination not to surrender more ground made the Red Army's task even easier, because he had insisted that the second German defensive line be positioned close to the first. Together with the reserve troops, Soviet artillery was able to pulverize them both with equal ease. The Soviets also confused the Germans by staggering their attacks along the Vistula. Konev's 1st Ukrainian Front attacked on 12 January, the 3rd Belarusian Front attacked in East Prussia on the 13th, and Zhukov attacked on the 14th. Facing the three-pronged offensive, Army Group Center was outnumbered by more than 5-1 in men, more than 6-1 in artillery, almost 7-1 in armored fighting vehicles, and almost 10-1 in aircraft. Eventually, Hitler sent 40 German divisions eastwards from other fronts, but the Stavka estimated that the Red Army inflicted the loss of 400,000 men on the Germans during January. General Reinhardt, commander of Army Group Center since Model's transfer west, was bitterly disillusioned with the war, but remained in post because, typical of most generals by this stage, he saw no alternative to carrying on. But on 25 January, Hitler sacked Reinhardt for making one too many requests for Army Group Center to withdraw to safer positions. Not that Reinhardt's requests made sense either, however. As hopes of stemming the Allied tide or splitting the Allied coalition faded, the only purpose of withdrawal was to enable German troops to hold on a little longer until they had fought to the end. Virtually all of East Prussia was abandoned to the Soviets early on, for as it was not in the main direction of the Soviet advance, Hitler considered it less than crucial to Germany's war effort. The plight of the civilian population, most of whom tried and many of whom failed to reach safety further west, did not register with him. Contrary to post-war claims, saving fleeing civilians from the advancing Soviets was not a high priority for the Wehrmacht during the war's final months. The East Prussian port of Königsberg, which Hitler was anxious to retain, was one place where the Wehrmacht did make an attempt, albeit with tragic results. Because of poor weather and spirited local German counterattacks, Königsberg was spared the final Soviet assault until early April. But the Wehrmacht and civilian leadership's joint effort to evacuate the port's civilian population was ill-prepared and chaotic. A mass Soviet artillery bombardment on 6 April prompted them to try to get the population out. The local party leadership instructed the population to assemble for evacuation in the early hours of 9 April, but it proved impossible to organize the undisciplined mass, and the people had to return to the city to face their fate with the troops as the Soviets captured Königsberg 4 days later. German losses for the entire East Prussian campaign are unknown. That the Germans still retained some of their old abilities in defensive warfare, however, is evidenced by the approximately 460,000 dead and wounded they inflicted upon the Soviets during its course. Following General Reinhardt's sacking, Hitler cobbled together a new army group, Army Group Vistula, from the battered remains of Army Groups A and Center. In yet another example of SS encroachment on the army's turf, Hitler appointed none other than Himmler to be Army Group Vistula's commander. Himmler's military knowledge was non-existent, as Colonel Hans-Georg Eismann, the new Army Group's operations officer, later recalled. Himmler had spoken while energetically sweeping the pointer around the map. The quintessence of his rather obscure presentation had, however, been, "I shall bring the Russians to a halt here, and then smash them and hold them back." One had the involuntary impression of a blind man talking of colors. Himmler lasted 2 months in the job and failed ignominiously. His replacement, General Heinrici, had become a proven defensive warfare expert during his time on the Eastern Front. At last the army had clawed back some ground in its turf war with the SS, for all the practical good that did. In the meantime, the Soviets captured the Silesian industrial heartland, a by now irreplaceable economic resource for Germany. Army Group Center's 17th Army had to retreat from the area to avoid encirclement. Hitler allowed the retreat because he trusted Army Group Center's new commander, General Schörner, more than any other general. "I require clear and unequivocal fanaticism, nothing else," Schörner informed his troops characteristically on 27 February. But Schörner, his brutish and fanatical mentality notwithstanding, was neither a yes-man nor a knee-jerk stand-faster, and like Model, his leverage with Hitler did enable him to recommend withdrawals he thought were necessary. Army Group Center tried to relieve the regional capital, Breslau, with counterattacks executed by the 9th Army and the 6th SS Panzer Army, but by mid-March it had been driven back with the loss of a further 167,000 irreplaceable troops. Partly thanks to these local counterattacks, Breslau was the only one of Guderian's fortress cities standing until virtually the war's end. It did not fall until 6 May, albeit at terrible cost, with two-thirds of the city destroyed, 7,000 inhabitants killed, and a further 3,000 choosing to commit suicide. Schörner also had his hands full on the front of the River Oder. Here, German resistance stiffened as the Soviets advanced further and extended their supply lines. Schörner played a double game, assuring Hitler and the OKH that the Soviet advance on the Oder had reached its high point, while at the same time seeking to terrify his troops into resisting with all their strength. The Oder front would hold for 8 weeks, though primarily because Soviet forces had more important targets by now, Berlin to the north and Hungary to the south. During mid-February, Schörner's forces were able briefly to delay the Soviet drive on Hungary amid the harsh winter weather and challenging terrain of Slovakia. From late February onwards, however, the Soviets captured Budapest, withstood a German attempt to retake it, and advanced into Austria. Pomerania, like Silesia, was also lost by mid-March, though the Second Army, under Army Group North's command from 13 March, continued to hold the port of Danzig until early April. In doing so, it taught its opponents a further hard lesson in urban warfare. The Germans had time to fortify the port with bunkers, machine gun nests, artillery positions, minefields, and anti-tank ditches. Between 10 February and 4 April, they inflicted 175,000 casualties upon General Rokossovsky's 2nd Belarusian Front, losses that eventually prevented him from participating in the Battle of Berlin. Of course, all this was futile in the long run, and so too was the Germans' defense west of the Rhine. From late January onwards, it was the turn of the Western Allies to assail the diminished German forces facing them. Following the transfer of German formations to the east, German forces in the west now comprised fewer than 500,000 men in 59 divisions. They amounted to a third of German strength on the eastern front, and facing them were Western Allied armies that outnumbered them 7-1. German commands in the west continued to dwell on the overwhelming strength of Allied air power, particularly its ability to prevent them moving in daylight. They also beheld the immense scale of the Allies' logistical effort, not least their ability to lay down fuel pipelines that German aircraft could not destroy. The Germans were, however, assessing the actual fighting qualities of their opponents more fairly. Following their repulse in the Ardennes, they seem finally to have accorded some respect to U.S. forces. They still considered the Americans too reliant on firepower and insufficiently focused on maneuver, but acknowledged the rapidity of their advance, the proficiency of their artillery, and their resilience in defense. By contrast, they now considered the British cautious in attack without backup from artillery and air support. They reserved their greatest praise for the troops of the new formation facing them in Alsace, the French First Army, its battle-experienced and/or colonial troops at any rate. They also favorably appraised French artillery, intelligence, and reconnaissance. The French attacked in Alsace, following the repulse of the Germans' diversionary offensives there, from 20 January onwards. To their north, U.S. forces breached the Westwall during the first week of February. Army Group G tried to establish a defensive line on the River Mosel, but failed because its battle groups lacked sufficient combat strength or trucks, and because they possessed no heavy artillery. By the beginning of March, French and American forces had reached the whole of the Upper Rhine. Further north, however, Montgomery's 21st Army Group faced the enormous natural barrier of the Reichswald Forest. With the February thaw, the attackers had to move over sodden ground, and a diversionary U.S. attack further south was delayed because it was impossible to cross the River Ruhr. Montgomery could have carried out a detour operation, but pushed his forces on through the forest, convinced, mistakenly, that the Germans were about to collapse. It was not as bloody a slogging match as the U.S. advance through the Hürtgen, but it was arduous in the extreme. Yet by throwing so much of their remaining strength, grouped under the 1st Parachute Army, against the British and Canadians, the Germans made it easier for the U.S. 9th Army to break through to the Rhine to the south. Once that happened, trying to hold the West Bank was pointless. Yet the Germans continued to try. Field Marshal von Rundstedt declared that each house must be turned into a fortress. Following the loss of Upper Silesia, one of the few remaining industrial areas the Reich still controlled, he made particular play of holding on to the West Bank in order to protect the Ruhr. The enemy will try with all means to break into the west of the Reich and bring the Ruhr industry under his power. The Wehrmacht will be without weapons and the homeland without coal. My soldiers, you have hammered the enemy in the great autumn and winter battles. Continue to protect the German homeland, our women and children, who truly are working for you against foreign tyranny. Keep the back of the embattled Eastern Front free so that it can break the Bolshevik onslaught and liberate the German lands in the east again. The reality of the German defense on the west bank of the Rhine was far more prosaic. With most of the Germans' remaining divisions in the west now at regimental level strength, they increasingly had to stack their defensive bunkers with rear area supply troops in an attempt to give their combat troops more room for maneuver. Even then, the 19th Army was unable to man a third of its bunkers, and following the Reichswald battle, Major Paul Krenz told his Canadian captors that the principle that no inch of ground should be yielded in any circumstances was forcing junior officers to deceive their superiors, because such orders were impossible to carry out. The 416th Infantry Division, defending the River Saar, had to top up its dwindling battalions with flotsam from destroyed units and even with convicts. It lost nearly all its anti-tank weapons in the fighting west of the Rhine and was unable to move such heavy artillery as it possessed. Overall, the fighting on the west bank of the Rhine chewed up the bulk of remaining German strength on that front. During February, the Germans suffered losses of 60,000 dead and wounded and 300,000 captured. By early March, the Americans were at the Rhine at Cologne and Dusseldorf, and had gained a valuable foothold on the river's eastern bank at Remagen, thanks to the Germans' failure to destroy the bridge there. By 23 March, the British and Canadians, following an initial delay caused by the need to build their own bridges, were over the Rhine as well. German forces in the Ruhr and the Netherlands were isolated. Eisenhower planned to converge particularly large forces on the Ruhr before advancing east to link up with the Red Army and then overrun southern Germany. 21st Army Group advanced to the north, and General Jacob Devers's Franco-American 6th Army Group to the south, with Bradley's All-American 12th Army Group thrusting forwards in the center. One of the most famously poignant images of the war's final months is that of barely trained Panzerfaust-armed 14-year-old Hitler youth boys being sent to die against Allied tanks. But with its replacement system now collapsing rapidly, the Army's own final levy comprised schoolboys who were little older, recruited well before their studies had ended and given perfunctory training at best. So-called infantry and panzer divisions were raised from local schools and garrisons. At the end of February, 6,000 boys born in 1929 were called up to strengthen rear defense lines. A measure of how far desperation was breaking all taboos was that there were even calls for a women's battalion. Volkssturm units brought some benefit as long as they were used for static, particularly urban, defence and properly incorporated into the wider plans of the local Wehrmacht and party authorities. Too often, however, the party authorities would shift Volkssturm units without Wehrmacht consent and leave them dangerously exposed. Wehrmacht commanders themselves often failed to inform Volkssturm units about their plans, and at times sacrificed them as a rear guard while they got their own men out. Volkssturm units in the east sometimes fought fanatically, partly because of inherent anti-Slavism, partly to avoid being captured. For even if the Red Army did not kill them on capture, as older men they were less likely to survive Soviet captivity. The OKH also made reasonable efforts to integrate Volkssturm units into its plans. Conditions in the west were often the polar opposite.